certainly years when my money dropped in value, but there were years when I earned a lot more than 10% as well. Where does the money come from? How is it created? Imagine Willy Wonka from Roald Dahl's classic novel, Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, starting off with a little chocolate shop. Having big dreams, he wanted to make ice cream that didn't melt, chewing gum that never lost its flavor, and chocolate that would make even the devil sell his soul. But Willy didn't have enough money to grow his factory. He needed to buy a larger building, hire more of those creepy little workers, and purchase machinery that would make chocolate faster than he ever could before. So Willy hired someone to approach the New York Stock Exchange, and before Willy knew it, he had investors in his business. They bought parts of his business, also known as shares or stock. Willy was no longer the sole owner, but by selling part of his business to new shareholders, he was able to build a larger, more efficient factory with the shareholder proceeds, which increased the chocolate factory's profits because he was able to make more treats at a faster rate. Willy's company was now public, meaning that the share owners, should they choose to, could sell their stakes in Willy's company to other willing buyers. When a publicly traded company has shares that trade on a stock market, the trading activity has a negligible effect on the business. So Willy, of course, was able to concentrate on what he did best, making chocolate. The shareholders didn't bother him because, generally, minority shareholders don't have any influence in a company's day-to-day operations. Willy's chocolate was amazing. Pleasing the shareholders, he began selling more and more chocolate. But they wanted more than a certificate from the New York Stock Exchange or their local brokerage firm proving they were partial owners of the chocolate factory. They wanted to share in the business profits that the factory generated. This made sense because shareholders in a company are technically owners. So the board of directors, which was voted into their positions by the shareholders, decided to give the owners an annual percentage of the profits, known as a dividend, and everyone was happy. This is how it worked. Willy's factory sold about $100,000 worth of chocolate and goodies each year. After paying taxes on the earnings, employee wages, and maintenance costs, Willy Wonka's chocolate factory made year-to-year profit of $10,000. So the company's board of directors decided to pay its shareholders $5,000 of that annual $10,000 profit and split it among the shareholders. This is known as a dividend. The remaining $5,000 profit would be reinvested back into the business, so Willy could pay for bigger and better machinery, advertise his chocolate far and wide, and make chocolate even faster, generating higher profits. Those reinvested profits made Willy's business even more lucrative. As a result, the chocolate factory doubled its profits to $20,000 the following year, and it increased its dividend payout to shareholders. This, of course, caused other potential investors to drool. They wanted to buy shares in the factory, too. Now there were more people wanting to buy shares than there were people who wanted to sell them. This created a demand for the shares, causing the share price on the New York Stock Exchange to rise. If there are more buyers than sellers, the share price rises. If there are more sellers than buyers, the share price falls. Over time, the share price of Willy's business fluctuated, sometimes climbing, sometimes falling, depending on investor sentiment. If news about the company was good, it increased public demand for the shares, pushing up the price. On other days, investors grew pessimistic, causing the share price to fall. Willy's factory continued to make more money over the years. And over the long term, when a company increases its profits, the stock price generally rises along with it. Willy's shareholders were able to make money in two different ways. They could realize a profit from dividends, cash payments given to shareholders usually four times each year, or they could wait until their stock had increased substantially in value on the stock market and choose to sell some or all of their shares. Here's how an investor could hypothetically make 10% a year from owning shares in Willy Wonka's business. Montgomery Burns had his eye on Willy Wonka's chocolate factory shares, and he decided to buy $1,000 of the chocolate company's stock at $10 a share. After 1 year, if the share price rose to $10.50, This would amount to a 5% increase in the share price. $10.50 is 5% higher than the $10 that Burns paid. And if Burns was given a $50 dividend, we could say that he had earned an additional 5% because a $50 dividend is 5% of his initial $1,000 investment. So, if his shares gain 5% in value from the share price increase, and he makes an extra 5% from the dividend payment, then after 1 year, Burns potentially would have made a 10% profit on his shares. Of course, only the 5% dividend payout would go into his pocket as a realized profit. The 5% profit from the price appreciation as the stock rose in value would only be realized if Burns sold his Willy Wonka shares. Montgomery Burns, however, didn't become the richest man in Springfield by buying and selling Willy Wonka shares when they fluctuated in price. Studies have shown that, on average, investors who buy shares and sell them again quickly don't tend to make profits as high as investors who hold on to their shares over the long term. Burns held on to those shares for many years. Sometimes the share price rose and sometimes it fell. But the company kept increasing its profits, so the share price increased over time. The annual dividends kept a smile on Montgomery Burns' greedy little lips as his profits from the rising stock price, coupled with dividends, earned him an average potential return of 10% a year. However, Burns wasn't rubbing his bony hands together as gleefully as you might expect, because at the same time he bought Willy Wonka shares, he also bought shares in Homer's Donuts and Lou's Bar. Neither business worked out, and Burns lost money. Driving him really crazy, however, was missing out on shares in the joke store company, Bart's Barf Gags. If Burns had bought shares in this business, he would be laughing all the way to the bank. Share prices quadrupled in just 4 years. In the following chapter, I will show you that one of the best ways to invest in the stock market is to own every stock in the market, rather than trying to follow the strategy of Burns and guess which stocks will rise. Though it sounds impossible to buy virtually every stock in a given market, it's made easy by purchasing a single product that owns every stock within it. Before getting to that, remember that you can invest half of what your neighbors invest over your lifetime and still end up with twice as much money, if you start early enough. For patient investors, the aggregate returns of the world stock markets have dished out phenomenal profits. For example, the U.S. stock market has averaged 9.96% annually from 1920 to 2010. There were periods where it grew faster than that, while it dropped back at other times. But that 9.96% average return, as shown in Table 2.1, has provided some impressive long-term profits. Invest early, and invest frequently. The odds are high that you'll slowly grow very wealthy. Let me show you how. Table 2.1. How $1,000 would grow over time if it made 9.96% annually. 0 years of growth. Value, $1,000. 10 years of growth. Value, $2,584.32. 20 years of growth. Value, $6,678.74. 30 years of growth. $17,260.04. 40 years of growth, $44,604.58. 50 years of growth, $115,275.37. 60 years of growth, $297,909.16. 70 years of growth, $769,894.43. 80 years of growth, value, $1,989,658.28. 90 years of growth. Value, $5,141,925.80. Source, the Value Line Investment Survey, Morningstar. Rule 3. Small percentages pack big punches. In 1971, when the great boxer Muhammad Ali was still undefeated, U.S. basketball star Wilt Chamberlain suggested publicly that he stood a chance of beating Ali in the boxing ring. Promoters scrambled to organize a fight that Ali considered a joke. Whenever the ultra-confident Ali walked into a room with the towering Chamberlain within earshot, he would cup his hands and holler through them, "Timber!" While Chamberlain felt that one lucky punch could knock Ali out and that he stood a decent chance in a fight, the rest of the sporting world knew better. Chamberlain's odds of winning were ridiculously low, and his bravado could only lead to significant pain for the great basketball player. As legend has it, Ali's "Timber!" taunts eventually rattled Chamberlain's nerves to put a stop to the pending fight. Most people don't like losing, and for that reason there are certain things most of us won't do. If we're smart, sorry Wilt, we won't bet a professional boxer that we can beat him or her in the ring. We won't bet a prosecuting lawyer that we can defend ourselves in a court of law and win. We won't put our money down on the odds of beating a chess master at chess. But would we dare challenge a professional financial advisor in a long-term investing contest? Common sense initially suggests that we shouldn't. However, this may be the only exception to the rule of challenging someone in their given profession and beating them easily. With training, the average fifth grader can take on Wall Street. The kid doesn't have to be smart. He just needs to learn that when following financial advice from most professional advisors, he won't be steered toward the best investments. The game is rigged against the average investor because most advisors make money for themselves at their client's expense. The selfish reality of the financial service industry. The vast majority of financial advisors are salespeople who will put their own financial interests ahead of yours. They sell you investment products that pay them or their employers well, while you're a distant second on their priority list. Many of us know people who work as financial planners, and they're fun to talk to at parties or on the golf course. But if they're buying actively managed mutual funds for their clients, they're doing their clients a disservice. Instead of recommending actively managed mutual funds, which the vast number of advisors do, they should direct their clients toward index funds. Index funds, what experts love but advisors hate. Every nonfiction book has an index. Go ahead, flip to the back of this one and scan all those referenced words representing this book's content. A book's index is a representation of everything that's inside it. Now think of the stock market as a book. If you went to the back pages, the index, you could see a representation of everything that was inside that book. For example, if you went to the back pages of the U.S. stock market, you would see the names of such listed companies as Walmart, The Gap, ExxonMobil, Procter & Gamble, Colgate-Palmolive, and the directory would go on and on until several thousand businesses were named. In the world of investing, if you buy a U.S. total stock market index fund, you're buying a single product that has thousands of stocks within it. It represents the entire U.S. stock market. With just three index funds, your money can be spread over nearly every available global money basket. 1. A home country stock market index. For Americans, this would be a U.S. index. For Canadians, a Canadian stock index. 2. An international stock market index, holding the widest array of international stocks from around the world. 3. A government bond market index. Money you would lend to a government for a guaranteed stable rate of interest. I'll explain the bond index in Chapter 5, and in Chapter 6, I'll introduce you to four real people from across the globe who created indexed investment portfolios. It was easy for them, as you'll see, and it will be easy for you. That's it. With just three index funds, you'll beat the pants and the shirts, socks, underwear, and shoes off most financial professionals. Financial experts backing the irrefutable. Full-time professionals in other fields, let's say dentists, bring a lot to the layman. But in aggregate, people get nothing for their money from professional money managers. The best way to own common stocks is through an index fund. Warren Buffett, Berkshire Hathaway Chairman. If you were to ask Warren Buffett what you should invest in, he would suggest that you buy index funds. As the world's greatest investor, and as a man slowly giving away his fortune to charity, Warren Buffett's testimony is part of his pledge to give back to society. In this case, he's giving back knowledge. Be wary of the financial service industry and invest with index funds instead. I don't believe I would have amassed $1 million on a teacher's salary while still in my 30s if I were unknowingly paying hidden fees to a financial advisor. Don't think I'm not a generous guy. I just don't want to be giving away hundreds of thousands of dollars during my investment lifetime to a slick talker in a salesperson's cloak. And I don't think you should either. What would a Nobel Prize-winning economist suggest? The most efficient way to diversify a stock portfolio is with a low-fee index fund. Paul Samuelson, 1970 Nobel Prize in Economics. Arguably, the most famous economist of our time, the late Paul Samuelson, was the first American to win a Nobel Prize in Economics. It's fair to say that he knew a heck of a lot more about money than the brokers suffering from conflicts of interest at your neighborhood Merrill Lynch, Edward Jones, or Raymond James offices. The typical financial planner won't want you knowing this, but a dream team of economic Nobel laureates clarifies that advisors and individuals who think they can beat the stock market indexes are likely to be wrong time after time. They're just not going to do it. It's just not going to happen. David Kahneman, 2002 Nobel Prize in Economics, when asked about investors' long-term chances of beating a broad-based index fund. Kahneman won the Nobel Prize for his work on how natural human behaviors negatively affect investment decisions. Too many people, in his view, think they can fund managers who can beat the market index over the long haul. Any pension fund manager who doesn't have the vast majority, and I mean 70 or 80% of his or her portfolio, in passive investments, index funds, is guilty of malfeasance, nonfeasance, or some other kind of bad feasance. There's just no sense for most of them to have anything but a passive, indexed investment policy. Merton Miller, 1990 Nobel Prize in Economics. Pension fund managers are trusted to invest billions of dollars for governments and corporations. In the U.S., more than half of them use indexed approaches. Those who don't are, according to Miller, setting an irresponsible policy. I have a global index fund with all-in expenses at 8 basis points. Robert Merton, 1997 Nobel Prize in Economics. In 1994, Merton, a university professor emeritus at Harvard Business School, probably thought he could beat the market. After all, he was a director of long-term capital management, a U.S. hedge fund, a type of mutual fund I will explain in Chapter 8, that reportedly earned 40% annual returns from 1994 to 1998. That was before the fund imploded, losing most of its shareholders' money and shutting down in 2000. Naturally, a Nobel Prize winner such as Merton is a brilliant man, and he's brilliant enough to learn from his mistakes. When asked to share his investment holdings in an interview with PBS NewsHour in 2009, the first thing out of Merton's mouth was the global index fund that he owns, which charges just 8 basis points. That's just a fancy way of saying that the hidden annual fee for his index is 0.08%. The average retail investor working with a financial advisor pays between 12 to 30 times more than that in fees. These fees can cost hundreds of thousands of dollars over an investment lifetime. I'll show you how to get your investment fees down very close to what Robert Merton pays, learning from his mistakes. More often, alas, the conclusions supporting active management can only be justified by assuming that the laws of arithmetic have been suspended for the convenience of those who choose to pursue careers as active managers. William F. Sharpe, 1990 Nobel Prize in Economics. If you were lucky enough to have Sharpe living across the street, he would tell you that he's a huge proponent of index funds and suggests that financial advisors and mutual fund managers who pursue other forms of stock market investing are deluding themselves. If a financial advisor tries telling you not to invest in index funds, They're essentially suggesting that they're smarter than Warren Buffett and better with money than a Nobel Prize laureate in economics. What do you think? What causes experts to shake their heads? Advisors get paid well when you buy actively managed mutual funds, or unit trusts as they're known outside of North America, so they love buying them for their clients' accounts. Advisors rarely get paid anything, if at all, when you buy stock market indexes, and desperately try to steer their clients in another, more profitable direction. An actively managed mutual fund works like this. 1. Your advisor takes your money and sends it to a fund company. 2. That fund company combines your money with those of other investors into an active mutual fund. 3. The fund company has a fund manager who buys and sells stocks within that fund, hoping that their buying and selling will result in profits for investors. While a total U.S. stock market index owns nearly all the stocks in the U.S. market all of the time, an active mutual fund manager buys and sells selected stocks repeatedly. For example, an active mutual fund manager might buy Coca-Cola Company shares today, sell Microsoft shares tomorrow, buy the stock back next week, and buy and sell General Electric Company shares two or three times within a 12-month period. It sounds beneficially strategic, but academic evidence suggests that, statistically, buying an actively managed mutual fund is a loser's game when comparing it with buying index funds. Despite the strategic buying and selling of stocks by a fund manager for his or her fund, the vast majority of actively managed mutual funds will lose to the indexes over the long term. Here's why. When the U.S. stock market moves up by, say, 8% in a given year, it means the average dollar invested in the stock market increased by 8% that year. When the U.S. stock market drops by, say, 8% in a given year, it means the average dollar invested in the stock market dropped in value by 8% that year. But doesn't mean that if the stock market made, hypothetically speaking, 8% last year, every investor in U.S. stocks made an 8% return on their investments that year. Of course not. Some made more, some made less. In a year where the markets made 8%, half of the money that was invested in the market that year would have made more than 8%, and half of the money invested in the markets would have made less than 8%. When averaging all the successes and losses in terms of individual stocks moving up or down that year, the average return would have been 8%. Most of the money that's in the stock market comes from mutual funds and index funds, pension funds, and endowment money. So if the markets made 8% this year, what do you think the average mutual fund, pension fund, and college endowment fund would have made on their stock market assets during that year? The answer, of course, is going to be very close to 8%, before fees. We know that a broad-based index fund would have made roughly 8% during this hypothetical year because it would own every stock in the market, giving it the average return of the market. There's no mathematical possibility that a total stock market index can ever beat the return of the stock market. If the stock market makes 25% in a given year, a total stock market index fund would make about 24.8% after factoring in the small cost, about 0.2% of running the index. If the stock market made 13% the following year, a total stock market index would make about 12.8%. A financial advisor selling mutual funds seems at first glance to have a high prospect of getting his or her hand on your wallet right now. He or she might suggest that earning the same return that the stock market makes, and not more, would represent an average return, and that he or she could beat the average return through purchasing superior actively managed mutual funds. If actively managed mutual funds didn't cost money to run, and if advisors worked for free, investors' odds of finding funds that would beat the broad-based index would be close to 50-50. In a 15-year-long U.S. study published in the Journal of Portfolio Management, actively managed stock market mutual funds were compared with the Standard & Poor's 500 Stock Market Index. The study concluded that 96% of actively managed mutual funds underperformed the U.S. market index after fees, taxes, and survivorship bias. What's a survivorship bias? When a mutual fund performs terribly, it doesn't typically attract new investors, and many of its current customers flee the fund for healthier pastures. Often, the poorly performing fund is merged with another fund, or it is shut down. In November 2009, I underwent bone cancer surgery, where large pieces of three of my ribs were removed, as well as chunks of my spinal process. But you want to know something? My 5-year survivorship odds might be better than that of the average mutual fund. Examining 2 decades of actively managed mutual fund data, investment researchers Robert Arnott, Andrew Birkin, and Jia Yi tracked 195 actively managed funds before reporting that the funds had a 17% mortality rate. According to the article they published with the Journal of Portfolio Management in 2000 called How Well Have Taxable Investors Been Served in the 1980s and 1990s, 33 of the 195 funds they tracked disappeared between 1979 and 1999. No one can predict which funds are going to survive and which won't. The odds of picking an actively managed fund that you think will survive are no better than predicting which bone cancer survivor will last the longest. When the best funds turn malignant. You might think that the very best funds, those with long-established track records, are large enough and strong enough to have a predictable longevity. They can't suddenly turn sour and disappear, can they? That's what investors in the 44 Wall Street Fund thought. It was the top-ranked fund of the 1970s, outperforming every diversified fund in the industry and beating the S&P 500 index for 11 years in a row. Its success was temporary, however, and it went from being the best-performing fund in one decade to being the worst-performing fund in the next, losing 73% of its value in the 1980s. Consequently, its brand name was MUD, so it was merged into the Cumberland Growth Fund in 1993, which then was merged into the Matterhorn Growth Fund in 1996. Today, it's as if it never existed. Then there was the Lindner Large Cap Fund, another stellar performer that attracted a huge following of investors as it beat the S&P 500 index for each of the 11 years from 1974 to 1984. But you won't find it today. Over the next 18 years, from 1984 to 2002, it made its investors just 4.1% annually, compared with the 12.6% annual gain for investors in the S&P 500 index. Finally, the dismal track record of the Lindner Large Cap Fund was erased when it was merged into the Hennessy Total Return Fund. You can read countless books on index performance track records versus actively managed funds. Most say index funds have the advantage over 80% of actively managed funds over a period of 10 years or more. But they don't typically account for survivorship bias or taxes, which I'll discuss later in this chapter, when making the comparisons. Doing so gives index funds an even larger advantage. When accounting for fees, survivorship bias, and taxes, most actively managed mutual funds dramatically underperform index funds. In taxable accounts, the average U.S. actively managed fund underperformed the U.S. Standard & Poor's 500 Stock Market Index by 4.8% annually from 1984 to 1999. Holes in the hulls of actively managed mutual funds. There are 5 factors dragging down the returns of actively managed U.S. mutual funds. Expense ratios, 12b1 fees, trading costs, sales commissions, and taxes. Many people ask me why they don't see these fee liabilities mentioned on their mutual fund statements. With the possible exception of expense ratios and sales commissions in very small print, the rest are hidden from view. Buying these products over an investment lifetime can be like entering a swimming race while towing a hunk of carpet through the water. 1. Expense ratios. Expense ratios are costs associated with running a mutual fund. You might not realize this, but if you buy an actively managed mutual fund, hidden fees pay the salaries of the analysts and/or traders to choose which stocks to buy and sell. These folks are some of the highest paid professionals in the world. As such, they are expensive to employ. There's also the cost of maintaining their computers, paying office leases, ordering the paper they shuffle, using electricity, and compensating the advisors slash salespeople for recommending their funds. Then there are the owners of the fund company. They receive profits based on the costs skimmed from mutual fund expense ratios. I'm not referring to the average Joe who buys fund units in the mutual fund. I'm referring to the fund company's owners. A fund holding a collective $30 billion would cost its investors, the average Joe, about $450 million every year, or 1.5% of its total assets in expense ratio fees. That money is sifted out of the mutual fund's value, but it isn't itemized for investors to see. And the cash comes out whether the mutual fund makes money or not. 2. 12b-1 fees. Not every actively managed fund company charges 12b-1 fees, but roughly 60% in the U.S. do. They can cost up to 0.25% or a further $75 million a year for a $30 billion fund. These pay for marketing expenses, including magazine, newspaper, television, and online advertising that's meant to lure new investors. That money has to come from somewhere, so current investors pay for new investors to join the party. It's like a masked phantom pulling money from the wallets of mutual fund investors every night. Financial advisory statements don't itemize these expenses either. 3. Trading costs. A third fee includes the fund's trading costs, which fluctuate year to year based on how much buying and selling the fund managers do. Remember, actively managed mutual funds have traders at the helm who buy and sell stocks within the fund to try and gain an edge. But on average, according to the global research company Lipper, the average actively managed stock market mutual fund accrues trading costs of 0.2% annually, or $60 million a year on a $30 billion fund. The costs of trading, 12b-1 fees, and expense ratios aren't the only invisible albatrosses around the necks of mutual fund investors. 4. Sales commissions. If the three hidden fees above are bringing you back in time to the nightmarish bottom of an elementary school dog pile, I have worse news for you. Many fund companies charge load fees, either a percentage up front to buy the fund, which goes directly to the salesperson, or a fee to sell the fund, which also goes directly to the salesperson. These fees can be as high as 6%. Many financial advisors love selling loaded funds, which add a pretty nice kick to their own personal accounts, but they aren't such a great deal for investors. A fund charging a sales fee of 5.75%, for example, has to gain 6.1% the following year just to break even on the deposited money. That might sound like strange math at first, but if you lose a given percentage to fees, you have to gain back a higher percentage to get your head back above water. For example, losing 50% in 1 year, turning $100 into $50, ensures that you will need to double your money the following year to get back to the original $100. Advisors choosing loaded funds for their clients put a whole new spin on piggy bank, don't you think? 5. Taxes. More than 60% of the money in U.S. mutual funds is in taxable accounts. This means when an actively managed mutual fund makes money in a given year, the investor has to pay taxes on that gain if the fund is held in a taxable account. There's a reason for that. Actively managed stock market mutual funds have fund managers who buy and sell stocks within their funds. If the stocks they sell generate an overall profit for the fund, then the investors in that fund, if they hold the fund in a taxable account, get handed a tax bill at the end of the year for the realized capital gain. The more trading a fund manager does, the less tax efficient the fund is. In the case of a total stock market index fund, there's virtually no trading. The gains that are made on the stocks held don't generate a taxable hit for the fund's investors unless the investor sells the fund at a higher price than he or she paid. Rather than paying a high rate of capital gains tax every year, the index investor is able to defer his or her gains, paying them when he or she eventually sells the fund. Doing so allows for significantly higher compounding profits. Mutual fund managers know that few people are going to compare their after-tax results with other mutual funds. For example, a fund making 11% a year might end up beating a fund making 12% a year after taxes. What makes one fund less tax efficient than another? It's the frequency of their buying and selling. The average actively managed mutual fund trades every stock it has during an average year. This is called a 100% turnover. The trading practices of most mutual fund managers trigger short-term capital gains to the owners of those funds when the funds make money. In the U.S., the short-term capital gain tax is a hefty penalty, but few actively managed fund managers seem to care. In comparison, index fund investors pay far fewer taxes in taxable accounts because index funds follow a buy-and-hold strategy. The more trading that occurs within a mutual fund, the higher the tax is incurred by the investor. In the Bogle Financial Markets Research Center's 15-year study on after-tax mutual fund performances from 1994 to 2009, it found actively managed stock market mutual funds were dramatically less tax efficient than a stock market index. For example, if you had invested in a fund for your taxable account that equaled the performance of the stock market index from 1994 to 2009, you would have paradoxically made less money than if you had invested in an index fund. But why would you have made less money if your fund had matched the performance of the stock index? Before taxes, if your fund matched the performance of the U.S. index, you would have averaged 6.7% per year. After taxes, though, for the actively managed fund to make as much money as a U.S. index fund, it would have needed to beat the index by a total of 16.2% over the 15-year period. This is assuming that the mutual fund manager bought and sold stocks with a regularity that equaled the average actively managed fund turnover. A post-tax comparison of a mutual fund's performance against the performance of a stock market index isn't something that you will likely see on a typical mutual fund statement. But in a taxable account, the post-tax gain is the only number that should count. Adding high expense ratios, 12b1 fees, trading costs, sales commissions, and taxes to your investment is a bit like a boxer standing blindfolded in a ring and asking his opponent to hit him 5 times on the jaw before the opening bell. It's tough to put up a fair fight when you're already bleeding. Figure 3.1. Dilbert's take on mutual funds. Source: Dilbert Comics. Dogbert says to Dilbert, "I'm starting a mutual fund for investors who aren't bright enough to know their alternatives. It must be a huge market, otherwise most people would invest in index funds." Dilbert says, "What's an index fund?" Dogbert replies, "Ouch, ouch, you're making me wag too hard." Figure 3.1 illustrates that if you learn this in school, it's likely that you would never consider investing in actively managed funds as an adult. The futility of picking top mutual funds. You've just told your financial advisor that you'd like to invest in index funds, and now she's desperate. She won't make money, or not much, if you invest in indexes. It's far more lucrative for advisors to sell actively managed mutual funds instead. She needs you to buy the products for which she will be compensated handsomely. So here's the card she plays. "Look, I'm a professional, and our company has access to researchers who will help me choose actively managed funds that will beat the indexes. Just look at these top-rated funds. I can show you dozens of them that have beaten the stock market index over the past 10 years. Of course, I would only buy you top-rated funds." Are there dozens of funds that have beaten the stock market indexes over the past 5, 10, or 15 years? Sure there are. But those funds, despite their track records, aren't likely to repeat their winning streaks. Mutual fund investing is a rare example of how, paradoxically, historical excellence means nothing. Reality check. Morningstar, www.morningstar.com, is an investment research firm in the U.S. that awards funds based on a 5-star system. 5 stars for a fund with a remarkable track record, all the way down to 1 star for a fund with a poor track record. Five-star funds tend to be those that have beaten the indexes over the previous 5 or 10 years. The problem is that fund rankings change all the time, and so do fund performances. Just because a fund has a 5-star rating today doesn't mean that it will outperform the index over the next year, 5 years, or 10 years. It's easy to look back in time and see great performing funds, but trying to pick them based on their historical performance is an expensive game. Academics refer to something they call reversion to the mean. In practical terms, actively managed funds that outperform the indexes typically revert to the mean or worse. In other words, buying the top historically performing funds can end up being the kiss of death. If an advisor had decided to purchase Morningstar's 5-star rated funds for you in 1994, and if he sold them as the fund slipped in the rankings, replacing them with the newly selected 5-star funds, how do you think the investor would have performed from 1994 to 2004 compared with a broad-based U.S. stock market index fund? Thanks to Holbert's Financial Digest, an investment newsletter that rates the performance predictions of other newsletters, we have the answer, which is emphasized in Figure 3.2. Figure 3.2. 5-star funds versus total stock market index 1994 to 2004. Source, John C. Bogle, The Little Book of Common Sense Investing. 5-star funds, total stock market index. Before tax, 5-star funds, $194. Total stock market index, $283. After tax, 5-star funds, $165. Total stock market index, $271. $100 invested and continually adjusted to only hold the highest rated Morningstar funds from 1994 to 2004 would have turned into roughly $194, averaging 6.9% annually. $100 invested in a broad-based U.S. stock market index from 1994 to 2004 would have turned in roughly $283, averaging 11% annually. If you add further taxable liabilities, the results for the Morningstar Superfunds would look even worse. You might as well be running with a monkey on your back. $100 invested and continually adjusted to only hold the highest-rated Morningstar funds from 1994 to 2004 would have turned into roughly $165 after taxes, at 5.15% annually. $100 invested in a broad-based U.S. stock market index from 1994 to 2004 would have turned into roughly $271 after taxes at 10.5% annually. Interestingly, more than 98% of invested mutual fund money gets pushed into Morningstar's top-rated funds. But choosing which actively managed mutual fund will perform well in the future is, in Burton Malkiel's words, like an obstacle course through Hell's Kitchen. Malkiel, a professor of economics at Princeton University and the best-selling author of A Random Walk Guide to Investing, adds, "There is no way to choose the best actively managed mutual fund managers in advance. I have calculated the results of employing strategies of buying the funds with the best recent year performance, best recent 2-year performance, best 5-year and 10-year performance, and not one of these strategies produced above average returns. I calculated the returns from buying the best funds selected by Forbes magazine, and found that these funds subsequently produced below average returns." Still, most financial advisors won't give up. Their livelihood depends on you believing that they can do it, that they can find funds that will beat the market indexes. Before we were married, my wife Pele was being helped by the U.S.-based financial service company Raymond James. www.raymondjames.com/personal_investing/. She was sold actively managed mutual funds. And on top of the standard hidden mutual fund fees, she was charged an additional 1.75% of her account value every year. An ongoing annual fee such as this, called a wrap fee, advisor fee, or account fee, is like a package of arsenic-laced cookies sold at your local health food store. Why did her advisor charge her this extra fee? Let's just say the advisor was servicing my wife the way the infamous Jesse James used to service train passengers, by taking the money and running. According to a 2007 article published in the U.S. weekly industry newspaper Investment News, Raymond James representatives are rewarded more for generating higher fees. In the style of a 401k plan, the new deferred compensation program this year gives a bonus of 1% to affiliated Raymond James reps who produce $450,000 in fees and commissions, a 2% bonus for $750,000 producers, and 3% for reps and advisors who produce $1 million. After that, the bonus, which will affect about 500 of the firm's 3,600 reps, increases 1 percentage point for every additional $500,000 in production, topping out at 10% for reps who produce $3.5 million in fees and commissions. That pushes those elite reps' payout to 100% or even more of their production, according to the company. With pilfering incentives like these, salespeople and advisors make out like sultans. Looking at my wife's investment portfolio in 2004, after tracking her account's performance, I calculated that her $200,000 account would have been $20,000 better off if she had been with an index fund over the previous 5 years instead of with her advisor's actively managed mutual funds. In my calculation, I included the 1.75% annual fleecing fee her advisor charged on top of the mutual fund's regular expenses. When Pele asked her advisor about her account's relatively poor performance, he suggested some new mutual funds. When Pele asked about index funds, he dismissed the idea. Perhaps he had his eye on a big prize, a Porsche or an Audi convertible. He couldn't afford either if he bought his client index funds. So he switched her into a group of different actively managed funds that had beaten the indexes over the previous 5 years. All had Morningstar 5-star ratings. And how did those new funds do from 2004 to 2007? Badly. Despite the strong track records of those funds, they performed poorly relative to the market indexes after he selected them for Pele's account. So, Pele fired the guy, and I married Pele. Over an investment lifetime, it's a virtual certainty that a portfolio of index funds will beat a portfolio of actively managed mutual funds after all expenses. But over a 1, 3, or even a 5-year period, there's always a chance that a person's actively managed funds will outperform the indexes. At a seminar I gave in 2010, a man I'll call Charlie, after seeing the returns of an index-based portfolio, said, "My investment advisor has beaten those returns over the past 5 years." That's possible, but the statistical realities are clear. Over his investment lifetime, the odds are that Charlie's account will fall far behind an indexed portfolio. In July 1993, the New York Times decided to run a 20-year contest pitting high-profile financial advisors and their mutual fund selections against the returns of the S&P 500 stock market index. Every 3 months, the newspaper would report the results as if the money was invested in tax-free accounts. The advisors were allowed to switch their funds at no cost whenever they wished. What started out as a great publicity coup for these high-profile money men quickly turned into what must have felt like a quarterly tarring and feathering. After just 7 years, the S&P 500 index was like a Ferrari to the advisors' Hyundai Sonatas, as revealed in Figure 3.3. Figure 3.3, the New York Times Investment Contest. Fund advisors versus S&P 500 index, July 1993 through June 2000. S&P 500 Index Fund, $188,755. Howard R. Avensky, $111,815. Russell Kinnell, $123,485. Jack A. Brill, $150,070. Sheldon Jacobs, $152,210. Eric Cobrin, $155,095. An initial $50,000 with the index fund in 1993, compared with the following respective advisors' mutual fund selections, would have turned into the preceding sums by 2000. Mysteriously, after just 7 years, the New York Times discontinued the contest. Perhaps the competitive advisors in the study grew tired of the humiliation. Finding help without a conflict of interest. I'll liken the average financial advisor to chocolate cake. Can following a decadent nutritional plan of sugary baked goods make you feel good? Sure, for about 30 seconds, as your taste buds relish the sticky sweetness. But the average financial advisor is as good for your long-term wealth as a chocolate cake diet is to your long-term health. That said, there are financial advisors who charge by the hour for objective advice. While no one wants to add another bill to the pile, a fee-only financial planner charging an hourly rate can be a professional partnership that helps you create a successful portfolio of index funds. For Americans, there's an easy option. You can give your money to Vanguard, www.vanguard.com, a U.S.-based nonprofit financial service company that happens to be the world's largest provider of index funds. You pay a small fee of $250 a year, and an advisor working for Vanguard will help you invest your money. When your account exceeds $250,000, the service is free. Asset Builder, www.assetbuilder.com, is another option. Based in Texas, this company charges low fees to operate as a broker that purchases index funds through a group called Dimensional Fund Advisors. www.dfaus.com/. The small annual percentage fee for the service allows you to wipe your hands clean of managing your money yourself. The following companies also charge low fees to build accounts of index funds for U.S. clients. RW Investments, www.rwinvestmentstrategies.com/background.html, based in Maryland. Aperio Group, www.aperiogroup.com/, based in California. And Evanson Asset Management, www.evansonasset.com/, based in California. There are other companies offering similar services, but be careful. Not all fee-only businesses offer low-fat services. Where hidden calories lie. The number of fee-only certified financial planners is increasing in the U.S., but you have to be careful. Fee-based advisor Burt Whitehead says in his book, Why Smart People Do Stupid Things with Money, that there are many organizations, such as American Express, that offer supposedly fee-based services, charging a small fee for a consultation, but they actually stuff investment accounts with their own brand of actively managed mutual funds and insurance products. Actively managed mutual funds pad the coffers of investment service companies, so they are good for the businesses that sell you such products, but they're not good for you. My hope, though, is that this book will give you every tool required to build portfolios of index funds yourself. Then you can hire a trustworthy accountant to provide advice on tax-sheltered accounts. Seeking an accountant's advice, you'll confidently avoid every conflict of interest corrupting the financial service industry, as long as your accountant doesn't sell financial products on the side. For a review, however, let's take another look at total stock market index funds and actively managed mutual funds with a side-by-side comparison. Table 3.1. Differences between actively managed funds and index funds. Actively managed mutual funds. 1. A fund manager buys and sells, trades, dozens or hundreds of stocks. The average fund has very few of the same stocks at the end of the year that it held at the beginning of the year. Total stock market index fund. 1. A fund manager buys a large group of stocks, often more than 1,000. More than 96% of the stocks are the same from 1 year to the next. No trading occurs. Poor businesses that get dropped from the stock exchange get dropped from the index. New businesses get added. Actively managed mutual funds. 2. The fund manager and his or her team conduct extensive research. Their high salaries compensate them for this service, adding to the cost of the fund. This added cost is paid by investors. Total Stock Market Index Fund. 2. No research is done on individual stocks. A total market index fund can literally be run by a computer with no research costs. Its goal is to virtually own everything on the stock market so there are no trading decisions to make. Actively managed mutual funds. 3. Stock trading, the buying and selling of stocks within the fund, generates commission expenses which are taken out of the value of the mutual fund. The investors pay for these. Total Stock Market Index Fund. 3. Because there's no trading involved, commissions for buying and or selling are extremely low. The savings are passed down to investors. Actively managed mutual funds. 4. Trading triggers tax consequences that are passed down to the investor when the fund is held in a taxable account. The tax man sends you a bill. Total Stock Market Index Fund. 4. The lack of trading means that, even in a taxable account, capital gains can grow with minimal annual taxation. You keep the tax man at bay. Actively managed mutual funds. 5. The fund manager focuses on certain stock sizes and sectors. For example, a small cap fund would own small companies only. A large cap fund would own large companies only. A value fund would own cheap companies only. A growth fund would own growth companies only. Total Stock Market Index Fund. 5. A total stock market index would own stock in every category listed on the left, all wrapped up into one fund because it owns the entire stock market. Actively managed mutual fund. 6. Companies offering mutual funds have owners who profit from the fund's fees. More fees raked from investors mean higher profits for the fund company's owners. Total Stock Market Index Fund. 6. A fund company such as Vanguard is a non-profit company. Vanguard is the world's largest provider of index funds, serving Americans, Australians, and the British. Low-cost indexes are also available to Asians, Canadians, and Europeans. Actively managed mutual funds. 7. Because mutual fund companies have owners who seek profits for their fund company, there are aggressive sales campaigns and incentives paid to salespeople, advisors, to recommend their funds for clients. Investors pay for these. Total Stock Market Index Fund. 7. Salespeople rarely tout indexes because they are less profitable for financial service companies to sell. Actively managed mutual funds. 8. Actively managed fund companies pay annual trailer fees to advisors, rewarding them for selling their funds to investors who end up paying for these. Total Stock Market Index Fund. 8. Index funds rarely pay trailer fees to advisors. Actively managed mutual funds. 9. Most U.S. fund companies charge sales or redemption fees, which go directly to the broker slash advisor who sold you the fund. The investor pays for these. Total Stock Market Index Fund. 9. Most index funds do not charge sales or redemption fees. Actively managed mutual funds. 10. Actively managed mutual fund companies are extremely well-liked by advisors and brokers. Total Stock Market Index Fund. 10. Index funds are not well-liked by most advisors and brokers. Global Citizens and Index Funds. If you're British or Australian, you can follow the lead with Vanguard, which has already set up shop in your country. As a non-profit group, it might be the world's cheapest financial service operator, and indexing is their specialty. If you're from another country, or if you're a global citizen working overseas, there are indexing options available for you as well, which I will discuss in Chapter 6. As high as U.S. actively managed stock mutual funds can run, the average non-U.S. fund is even more expensive. In a study presented in 2008 by Oxford University Press, A.J. Khurana, Henri Servais, and Peter Tufano compared international fund costs, including estimated sales fees. According to the study, the country with the most expensive stock market mutual funds is Canada. Fortunately for Canadians, Vanguard is planning to extend its services to its long-suffering northern neighbors. High global investment costs make it even more important for global citizens outside the U.S. to buy indexes for their investment accounts rather than pay the heavy fees associated with actively managed mutual funds. Table 3.2, the world's actively managed stock market mutual fund fees by country, total estimated expenses including sales costs, and ranking of least expensive to most expensive actively managed.